It's another edition of Making Money as we continue our shows on investment cycles. We started last week, Ron, with a list of 17 cycles, and we decided to break that down into two different shows about how these cycles, and I put that in quotation marks, can influence the way a market goes. And some of them are just, you had to do a lot of research on this because you don't go to a website called Investment Cycles and get a list. And because some of these cycles that we've touched on are less than reliable. Is that fair?
That is very fair, Gordon. Some of them are just used to market products and that have lucrative commissions attached so that the only person getting rich telling you the time to jump into a certain cycle is the guy that's peddling a product. So what we've tried to do is there's more cycles than 17, but I've tried to take most of the major ones and break them down and help you discern whether this particular cycle is worth looking at, and it can help you make decisions as an investor and those that don't.
Okay, we also talked before we went on the air today about some of the characters we've seen over the years that fall into that category. They're promoters. They come on and they tell you, oh, this is the next great thing, and look at my track record, and then you do a little research and find out, man, like if you were in the big leagues, you'd be sent down to the minors in a big hurry.
Yeah, actually, you'd probably be fired, and you wouldn't even go to the minors. You wouldn't collect gold. You'd go directly to jail. And, you know, I mean, we were talking about people that have been, you know, for example, in the last, well, 50 years, there's been three major gold cycles, and we're in the fourth one. And so that's a major gold cycle every, you know, 20, or every 15, you know, 10 to 15 years. And of course, the cycles only last about 2 years. The last three were 72 to 74, 78 to 80, and 2007 to 2010. But if you predicted gold's going to go up every year on in that literally 45 to 50 year span, you know, you would have had egg on your face. But if you're a good promoter and you're predicting it every year, you take the three predictions out of over the 45-year period that you had right, and you crow to high heaven about how accurate you were, but you leave out the other 42.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. You know, and that happens all the time. So you got to be very careful. So we've done a lot of in-depth research to show you just how accurate these things are and which ones are worth looking at and which ones aren't. And hopefully that'll help you avoid some of the real promoters in the industry that aren't really interested in anything but the profitability that they get from selling products and strategies really that don't work.
All right. Well, let's pick up on the next one here, the commodity stock cycle. Commodity is a pretty broad term, Ron.
Yeah, it usually includes things like mining, forest products, agriculture, energy. And if you take a look at the 10 major asset classes over the last 11 years, commodities being one asset class, they've been the worst performer four times and the best performer twice. So if you capture these big swings, you're going to have to do some trading and you're going to have a decent timing and especially good patience. But if you can get two big cycles a decade, which is generally what you get with commodities, and you get your timing right, these stocks, you know, in mining, in oil and gas, in forest products, when they go up, a lot of times we're not talking increases of 20, 30, 40%. We're talking increases of 100 and 200% from bottom to top. And they form bubbles, then the investors leave them, and these things sit unwanted and unloved for years, and then they start taking off again. So if you add a little bit of commodities to your portfolio when they're deeply out of favor and just be patient and wait, sometimes you can get some extraordinarily gains off these things. You just have to remember that generally you're getting two to three big cycles a decade, so you're going to have to be very patient to play this.
Okay, let's take a look at the company survival cycle. There aren't too many that survive forever, are there?
Yeah, and so if you look at the 50 most important companies listed on the New York Stock Exchange in 1911, only one of them exists today. That's General Electric. And even that was split into three businesses here a couple weeks ago. The average blue chip company in the Fortune 500 index in the U.S., that's the biggest, most blue chip company south of the border, only sticks around for 20 years before it ceases to exist. Now, not all these companies disappear due to bankruptcy or closure. Some of them get bought out or get
or they get merged by others. Or something. Yeah.
Yeah, they get merged. So competition out there is ferocious, eat or be eaten. So if you like to buy and hold durable businesses for a long period of time, you still need to check their pulse every so often, because even great companies can have an expiry date.
Okay, bear markets and economic cycles. Well, when the market's down, right?
Yeah, bear markets are when the markets are down. And this one has a pretty good track record. And over 90% of the time, if the stock market is down 30% or more, you're going to have a recession. So, you know, you see the stock market down, and stock markets often precede recessions. You know, they're an early indicator. Well, you can use that for a lot of things. You have a recession, often you're going to have cheaper real estate, businesses are going to slow down. And so this one has been accurate every time on a 30% drop since the 1930s. The only one exception was the bear market in 1987, which fell 33%. And no recession happened. And that was just because of trading that got out of hand. But other than that, you know, this is a pretty good indicator. If you see markets drop 30%, expect a recession.
The gold-silver cycle. We talked about gold a while back on the previous episode here. This is a different cycle in that regard.
Yeah, this is for those who want to trade silver. And silver, in its price relationship to gold, has buy and sell symbols. And they call this the gold-silver ratio or mint ratio. And what it says is it looks at how many ounces of silver it takes to buy an ounce of gold. And for traders, when it takes 80 or more ounces of silver to buy 1 ounce of gold, that's typically when you get a buy signal. And when you get a sell signal is when the number of ounces of silver to buy an ounce of gold drops to 40. In other words, the price of silver goes up, the price of gold goes down, that ratio narrows. So currently the ratio is sitting at 90 ounces of silver to 1 ounce of gold. And this has been, the last few years, this has been kind of more of a so-so indicator, because silver prices really haven't moved that much. Will it get more accurate in the future? It probably will, especially if silver has so many uses in electronics, especially. And if we have higher inflation levels and it's expensive for people to own gold, especially at $2,000 an ounce. With silver at $24 to $25 an ounce, it's called the poor man's gold, and that could help it. So that's what you want to watch for. Right now, frankly, it isn't the most reliable indicator going back at least a decade.
I had a chat with somebody not that long ago about silver, and we were talking about how it's sat down and it's been kind of depressed, and I just threw it out there, and I was talking through my hat probably, but then I thought about it. Well, maybe there is some relevance to that. Silver used to be used in such a big way in the photography industry. Well, everything's digital now. Not many people are getting photos developed anymore, right?
Not me, that's for sure.
Yeah.
And, you know, so the demand for silver has moved to, because silver is a good conductor of electricity.
Right.
So there's a big demand for it on
chips and things of that nature.
Yeah, chips and things like that. And it's also used in medicine. It's very healing for wounds. You know, there's other uses for it as well. And of course, there's always the jewelry and investment market. So when those things tend to pick up again, you know, I think this ratio might have more relevance. I'm not sure how much relevance it has right now, to be honest with you.
The next one we want to touch on is the investor's emotional cycle. And given the way that things are right now, Ron, there's a lot of instability in the world. We have war in the Middle East. We've got war in Ukraine. We've got a presidential election coming up in the States where a lot of people, doesn't matter whether you're left or right, seem to be arguing about the qualifications of the two candidates. A lot of uncertainty now. How is that affecting investment? The markets have been doing quite well through this.
Well, the economy generally oscillates between slightly warm to slightly cool. I mean, you look over the recent economic history, you know, you might have economic growth of 2 to 3%. And then if you have a pullback, you have a recession and maybe growth goes into the negative territory by a couple of percent. But these mild changes in the business environment are magnified to a much greater extent by investors' reactions. I mean, often, you know, you look at the last, since the year 2000. In the year 2000, the stock market dropped 48, 49%. In the year 2007 to 2009, markets dropped 56%. When COVID came along, markets dropped by a third. You know, so investor reaction tends to be massive and swift, and it often goes from a euphoria to hopelessness and back again when the actual economy doesn't have nearly the price swing. So rather than be terrified by these things, smart investors can use them opportunistically. And the big money is usually made when buying at the emotional tide as it's going out and then selling when it comes back in. And this cycle typically happens every 3.5 or 4 years. So if you're patient, you play the cycles, especially investor emotional cycles, you can make a lot of money.
Oil prices and economic cycles. Well, is oil, how often do we talk about the price of oil affecting things?
Yeah, well, every economic downturn in the past half century has been preceded by a sharp run-up in oil prices. And the only exception was the pullback in 2020, and that was caused by COVID-19. You know, we don't often have pandemics. In fact, the last global pandemic we had was the Spanish flu, and that was literally 100 years ago. So as dependence on oil and gas lessens, and as we move to a renewable economy, which will happen, but it's going to take some time, it'll be interesting to see how well this cycle holds up in the future. So generally, if you see a big spike in oil prices, and a sustainable spike, look out below because it's not great for the overall economy. So this has been a pretty dependable indicator. And like I say, it'll be interesting to see over the next couple of decades if it remains dependable as we move toward renewables.
All right. Well, boy, there's just so much to chew on here and all these different cycles. And if you're paying attention to them, should we be watching this one more than the other? Currency cycles. Do we worry about those as well?
Well, this is one of the most depressing statistics that I've seen over the last couple of years, Gord. And of the 750 currencies that have been around for the last 300 years, only 20% have survived.
Wow. I think of the Italian lira, right? Like,
oh, yeah. Or the Argentina, which has been has gone bankrupt, I think, in the last 100 years, has gone under 9 or 10 times and defaulted on its debt. It's pathetic. So, you know, some have blown themselves up. Some have disappeared as a result of war. And some have even just converted into something else, like the euro. And a whole bunch of, 20 currencies disappeared. And one currency is a survivor. So even among the survivors, like the dollar or the British pound, that have been around for hundreds of years and been relatively stable, inflation has chewed away at their buying power over the decades. And so if you look at over the last 100 years, you know, the British pound or the U.S. dollar, they have 2 to 3%, I think, of the buying power that they had a century ago. And that's why investors refer to cash as trash, and they prefer to hold real assets or assets that produce economic returns or wealth because they make profits. So sitting in cash is just not something you want to do because you get deflation, in one currency against another, you get them disappearing. So you want to be, if you're a conservative investor, you want to be in conservative currencies. And even then, you don't want to leave that money sitting around. You want to invest that money.
And here we are, we're sitting in Canada. We're all very attached to the Canadian dollar. And like I'm thinking in my lifetime, I've seen the dollar down in the 65-cent range. I think might have been the low 65 or 66 cent. I've seen it up at $1.10. And that, you know, that's a big spread.
Yeah, it was at a dollar. I remember going to school in the U.S. in the early 70s, and I was just amazed because I got $1.03 U.S. for every dollar Canadian. And then by the time I finished my schooling, I was getting around, if I converted a Canadian dollar to U.S. to go back to school, I was getting around 80 cents. So we've had in Canada, really, since the 75, so it's almost been 50 years now, we've had three cycles, go from a bottom, or go from a Canadian dollar being high to it dropping in 1990 to it, dropping in 1980s to about 1993. It rallied again big time, and then it dropped in 2003, and then you had a massive rally between 2005 and 2012 when the U.S. dollar was in trouble and everybody was moving out of the U.S., and then we had to go down again, and that's where we're sitting today. So very hard to predict because this is such a long cycle, and you know, the time to buy Canadian dollars is if you think the U.S. dollar is going to fall apart, and people are predicting the demise of the U.S. dollar now for, oh, as long as I've been in the business, the U.S. dollar is going to collapse because of its foreign debt, because of its wars, because of its the problems with politics, and the list goes on and on and on. But it hasn't.
All right, the January stock market cycle. We just passed that. How did it all look?
Yeah, well, what the Stock Traders Almanac, and if you want to look at cycles, these guys, the Stock Traders Almanac, you can buy it online, and actually it talks about all the cycles, and they've come up with a January cycle, and it's basically, as January goes, so goes the entire year. And if they're right, the market will be down this year, because in January of 2024, the first month was down 2%. Now, this indicator works pretty well if markets are going up, but it's got a lousy performance if in the first month of the year markets have gone down. So in the last 27 years, if the indicator is down, in other words, the markets have been down in the first month, in 13 of those cases, going back to 1950, the stock market actually ended up higher. So you can use this indicator if stock markets are up. They'll probably be up for the rest of the year. But if they're down, don't follow this indicator at all. It's really 50-50.
And here's the final one on the list, the 17 that you compiled, the yearly Canadian real estate sales cycle.
If you want to sell a home, the volume of sales between January and May usually triples. So, which means that typically homes settle in 30, 60, 90 days. So really the best time of year by a long shot to list your homes where there's a lot more buyers looking if you want to sell is April, May, June. Or sorry, February, March, April are the best months to put your home up for sale, because that's when the most people are looking, because nobody wants to move in Canada in the winter. And if you've got kids, if you settle in May or June, you can move out. You've got the summer to move in, and the kids will be ready to go to their new school come fall. Now, on the other hand, if you are a buyer, because there's so few listings, and usually the ones out there are often desperate sales, often the best time to buy a home in Canada. In fact, that's when I bought my last three homes when I was in Edmonton, was I bought them in November, December, and early January. because people have to get rid of them, and often they want to be out before Christmas. So if you're a bargain hunter, look late in the year, and especially when it's cold.
And pertaining to that early spring period you just talked, I just had lunch with a chap last week who was telling me he just bought a house, and there's bidding wars going on again because there's not much inventory out there. And he was fortunate enough to get in on one. He was in a financial position where he could close quickly. But yeah, like the market's right hot, red hot right now, it would appear anyway. All right, well, that's all of these cycles, Ron. So summing it up here, financial coach, how much attention do we pay to these things?
So if a cycle has a trend that happens to be right 70 or 80% of the time, it's probably a good bet to start paying attention to it, like the yearly cycle. Best time of year to make investments is generally in the fall. And like I say, it's a good time to make RSP investments, especially because markets tend to be a little weaker, and that's when you get your bargains. The real estate cycle is another one where, you know, every year sales volumes and prices generally go up in the spring. You want to, if you're selling, spring's a good time to sell. Winter is a good time to buy. You know, so if you find a cycle, then and we covered them all, and the percentages of that they're right, you know, you're getting a 70 or 80% of the time it works. Well, it's probably worth a bet. That's a high probability bet that you're making in the market. But you know, a lot of the others, like how do you invest with the Kondratiev cycle? How do you invest in the January cycle when if it's down? You got a 50% chance of being right. So there's just so many of the cycles, they're not even worth paying attention to.
They're sketchy. All right.
Yeah.
All right. Back next week with another edition of Making Money. And, you know, we've been doing this show about 5 years, and I would think during the bulk of that period, this was a no-go zone. We're going to talk about investing in Japan.
Yeah, Japan is finally broken the all-time high it hit on December of 1989, believe it or not.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of talk about and questions about, you know, is Japan finally back in a bull market? What should we make of it? Should we invest in it? If so, what are the rewards compared to the risk? Well, we're going to answer all those questions next week.
All right, we hope you can join us. On behalf of the financial coach, Ron Hebert, I'm Gord Whitehead. Thanks for listening. We'll join you next week with another edition of Making Money.
The information presented is derived from sources believed to be reliable. This material is presented for information purposes only and does not constitute investment advice. Before acting on any investment information, a person should seek advice from an investment professional. The presenters may or may not hold positions in the securities discussed on this show and will not be responsible for any losses sustained from acting on this information.